In the nation of Libya, the end of decades of dictatorship under Muammar Gaddafi came to a noisy, swift end in October of 2011. Libyans celebrating in the streets of Sirte after the death of Muammar Gaddafi and shouting in the middle of it all, wearing a Yankees baseball cap and waving the golden revolver of Colonel Gaddafi, was a young man named Mohammed al-Bibi. The image of al-Bibi became the symbol of all the contradictions and promise of the Arab Spring and the Libyan Revolution. Gabriel Gatehouse, foreign correspondent for BBC News, was at the scene of Gaddafi's death in 2011. He returned to Libya to explore the country's very chaotic present. Gabriel, what do you think the significance is of this golden revolver?
I was in Libya, in Sirte, the place where Colonel Gaddafi was caught and killed on that day. And the fighters were brandishing it around. They were passing it between each other like a sort of, not only a totem of their victory, but it also seemed to be a symbol of the transfer of power in the new Libya. So as such, what I wanted to know was what's happened to it now that the country has basically disintegrated into warring factions. We've got so-called Islamic State taking over in Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. As a symbol of that transfer of power, where is it now? Who has it now? And what does it mean to those people who were so full of hope back then?
And you really describe a story of chaos, of the breaking down of any sort of civil order. Anwar Suwan, who is in Misrata, spoke with you and was very close to Gaddafi's body after his death and is completely hopeless now.
Everyone has demands. All the parties are fighting each other. They cut off the head of the snake, Gaddafi, and now there are hundreds of snakes in his place.
Is he wishing for the days of Gaddafi?
No, he's not. He most definitely isn't. Although I think there are some who are. I mean, the breakdown of law and order is kind of selective in Libya. What it is more is the breakdown of Libya as a country. Misrata itself basically is quite safe. It rules itself as a kind of mini city state, and that seems to be increasingly the direction of travel in Libya. All these various different militias who are fiercely loyal to, you could call it tribe, you could call it geographical location. Sometimes it's got more to do with ideology. They are increasingly running their own little fiefdom. So what you get is pockets of security, but between them, a lot of insecurity. And that's the vacuum that Islamic State is exploiting.
Tell us about this pocket of insecurity at Leptis Magna, which is a Roman ruin in North Africa and is being guarded by people who really believe that they're on their own.
Yeah, this extraordinary guy, Ali Hribish, he must have been in his 60s, at least, possibly in his 70s, an old man with a Kalashnikov standing guard amidst these incredible ruins. They are some of the best bits of Roman architecture anywhere in North Africa. And these guys, him and just a handful of friends, basically, have taken it upon themselves as volunteers to stand guard against anyone, really. But obviously their biggest fear is Islamic State.
We will protect it ourselves. There is no help. There is no government. We will die if that's what it takes to stop them taking this place.
If they got to Leptis Magna, I think it's fair to assume that the fate of those amazing columns and amphitheatres would be similar to that of the Roman ruins at Palmyra in Syria, which we saw being dynamited not so long ago. But they are begging for help from anyone, from any of the various authorities, governments that run Libya, from the international community, and so far they're not seeing anything.
Do they believe that airstrikes and the help that they've gotten up until now is sufficient?
Well, at the moment, there's a big debate going on, not just inside Libya, but also in the United States and in other European capitals about what is the best way to tackle Islamic State. An opinion on the ground is divided on that. Libyans are fiercely proud of their country. They don't like the idea of foreign intervention, but many people acknowledge that they cannot take on Islamic State on their own, especially divided as they are. So the question is, what does the West do about it? about this. And what we've seen is the Pentagon and others quietly sending in small groups of special forces to go and suss out on the ground who might be, who among the armed factions might be good partners to partner up with. And I think at the moment they don't quite have the answer.
And what of this curious totem, the gun itself, which you actually came upon and found, and you see where it is today?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, the gun today is still with the same kid. He was 17 years old at the time, who I saw waving it above his head as he was being carried on the shoulders of his comrades on the 20th of October 2011, the day that they captured and killed Gaddafi. I found this guy, Mohammed. He still has the pistol. And I said, how did you... Why were you the hero? He seemed to be the hero. Everyone was cheering him on. And he said it was a misunderstanding. He didn't capture Gaddafi. He didn't take part in his killing. Simply, amid the confusion, he'd simply found the gun lying on the ground somewhere between Gaddafi's bombed-out convoy, it'd been hit by a French airstrike, and the sewage pipe, the drainage pipe that Gaddafi'd been hiding in. He found the gun on the floor. He picked it up. He started waving it around. All his fellow rebels thought, that's Gaddafi's golden gun. He must have been the guy who captured him. So he became the accidental hero of the revolution. But there's a darker side to this. He is fearful of what possession of that gun means. He says he's still got threats from pro-Gaddafi loyalists, people who are still loyal to the old regime, threats to his life. So while he's proud of it, he's proud of having been there on that day and having found this powerful symbol, he's also a little bit fearful of it.
Gabriel Gatehouse, foreign correspondent for BBC News. Thank you so much, Gabriel.
Always a pleasure.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.